It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss deer hunting and wildlife management proposals advancing through the legislature. Call in with a question. Share your comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Republican Representative Chance Green of Grand View represents a district in the northernmost part of Wisconsin, including Ashland, Bayfield, Iron, and Price counties. He's a member of the Assembly Committee on Forestry, Parks, and Outdoor Recreation and sits on the Sporting Heritage Committee. Representative Green, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So you co-authored this bill that would restrict antlerless deer hunting in northern Wisconsin over the next 4 years, and it is now advancing to the governor's desk. Why do you support this measure?
Gotcha. Well, great question. Northern Wisconsin has experienced a terrible decline in deer population over the past few years, and it's made for really just terrible deer hunting. We held about 6 listening sessions throughout the northern region over the past 6 months, and a lot of deer hunters turned out to these listening sessions and expressed their feelings towards the down deer numbers and the concerns and a lot of the factors, of course, with a high number of predators in northern Wisconsin, as well as with the exception of this one, of course, the last 2 winters have been very harsh. The deer population is way down. So this bill is in hopes to halt any more deer harvest and kind of protect the herd that we have, while we can hopefully sit down with the Wisconsin DNR and put together a proper deer management plan for northern Wisconsin.
Is it clear to you what is happening, what is causing this drop in deer in the northern forest zone? What's going on?
Well, it's a multi-factor thing, but like I said, harsh winters, an abundance of predators, and because we have more public land than most of the state, we have an abundance of deer hunters, whether it's from southern Wisconsin or from out of state. So everything in northern Wisconsin is against the whitetail. So we are just hoping to put a halt on our deer harvest and put together a proper management plan, which would include looking at all the predator management plans, bear, bobcat, coyote. Wolf is a big factor, but unfortunately we can't address that issue until the federal government acts. But another plan is looking at out-of-state licensing, looking at the forestry plan. How are we not only maximizing profit when it comes to our forestry plan, but are we also maximizing deer habitat? Are we doing the best management practice in our forestry plan to promote deer habitat? So all these factors come into play, and like I said, hopefully over the next 4 years, if Governor Evers signs this bill, we can sit down with the DNR, the forestry, take in public input, and work on all these issues to hopefully address our declining deer population.
Can you explain here for a moment what the proposal would do and the restrictions that are proposed here for northern Wisconsin? Explain how these limits would affect hunters.
Gotcha. So it would eliminate doe hunting in the northern forest zone, which is about, and I apologize, I want to say it's roughly 16 counties. According to the DNR, roughly 13 of those need to increase deer population. So this bill would just simply eliminate doe hunting for the next 4 years and allow for us to, again, sit down with the DNR and put together a proper plan. We did put an amendment on this bill going into our Sporting Heritage Committee to allow for youth hunters under 16, or 16 and under, I should say, to harvest a doe or a buck during the youth hunt. There have been concerns about how this would affect the youth, and we do have declining numbers when it comes to kids getting involved with hunting, so we didn't want to continue that. So we're hoping that that amendment would keep kids interested, allowing them to take a deer either way, a buck or a doe, one or the other, during the youth hunt, and allow that, you know, hopefully get them hooked on hunting. But yes, that's more or less what the bill does.
We're talking with Republican State Representative Chance Green of Grandview about hunting regulations specifically for deer in northern Wisconsin and a bill headed to the governor's desk. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. This legislation says restrictions would remain in effect for 4 years for hunting seasons. Why 4 years?
Well, that's a great question. I wanted to make sure that we open the window wide enough to give us time to hash these things out. In a meeting with the DNR prior to our Sporting Heritage Committee meetings, I asked them how long it would take to adjust, say, the bear hunt management plan. You know, again, all of these are factors, the bear management plan, the bobcat management plan, forestry plan moving forward. So I asked them simply, how long would it take to adjust if we wanted to make changes to any of these plans? And the DNR told me about 3 years. So any adjustments we do make regarding the deer management plan for northern Wisconsin, it's going to take time. And again, we want to make sure we get everybody to the table when we have those conversations so that we get everybody's input and we figure out how it's affecting everybody, and that way we can put a proper plan together.
Do you think a proper plan means an individualized plan for each county, or do you think that numbers should be set for the state as a whole?
So I think northern Wisconsin is its own environment, and I think it needs, you know, like I said, that northern forest zone needs its own plan. But with that said, I personally believe we should go back to somewhat of a DMUs, deer management units, were used prior to 2014, and that breaks down counties specifically on, you know, habitat, what food is available in that area. And I think we need to go back to that plan type to that, because I use Bayfield County, for example. In Bayfield County, we have the northern area, which is a lot of the barrens, they call it. It's mm-hmm. a lot of public hunting land. You get to central Bayfield County, it's a lot of farmland, and where there's an abundance of deer. And then you get to southern Bayfield County, where it's a lot of federal lands, where there's not a lot of deer. So that's how I would see Bayfield County getting broke up in that plan. Limiting your amount of doe tags given in the southern and northern zone, and maybe targeting more doe tags towards the central zone. That is kind of what we were hoping to see, just because northern Wisconsin varies so drastically in habitat and feeding and things like that. So we'd like to see a specific plan to that need. And a lot of people say, well, that's what CDACs are for. CDACs are the committees assigned per county to designate how many doe tags are given out during a season. But during our listening sessions, we heard a lot of comments, a lot of public comments, and multiple listening sessions had well over 200 people. There's a distrust in the CDAC committee's process. And as well-intended as I think they were, I don't know that the CDACs were properly implemented. So that's become an issue that we would also like to look into.
Taking a much more curated approach to deer management. Representative Chance Green is here, a Republican representing a district in the northernmost reaches of Wisconsin, including Ashland and Bayfield counties, as we've been talking about. As we discuss hunting management legislation, call in with a question. You can add your comments at 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the legislature winds down its session, we explore bills that gain traction on deer hunting management and natural resources. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Republican Representative Chance Green of Grandview sits on the Assembly's Forestry, Parks, and Outdoor Recreation Committee. Let's bring in Mike in Vilas County. Mike, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Well, you know, I've got a lot to say, and I'll try and make it quickly. I'm from Vilas County. I had a wonderful hunt. I put out a lot of game cameras. I see a lot of deer. I don't see the predators like they're saying. And I spent a lot of time in the woods. And one thing you got to remember up here is baiting is illegal, but it's absolutely everywhere. And the other issue is people are just sitting on their stands and they're not pursuing game. That's not hunting. This bill that he's talking about is an anti-hunting bill. It's really affected our ability to recruit younger hunters. And, you know, it's frustrating because they talk about all these predators, and there's predators out there, but there's research that's been done that I can provide from old DNR magazines from back in the 60s that explain all this stuff. And part of the problem is people come up here, they sit for 2 days over a bait pile, and they expect deer to come to them during a nine-day gun season. That's not realistic. I saw deer almost every single day when I went out walking around in the woods. So, and I'm on a CDAC committee. I represent transportation. Just a contractor and a few people that turn in or call in car-killed deer. There was over 700 deer picked up off our highways, and those are just the ones that were picked up on by contractors. And those are only picked up on the roadway. All those deer in the ditch, those aren't counted. So there's over 1,000 deer being killed on our highways.
And Mike, I want to jump in here to allow Representative Chance Green to respond to how you have felt and what you have seen in the woods in your hunts. Mike, also on a County Deer Advisory Council. Representative Green, go ahead.
Yes, great to hear from you, Mike. And I would agree. There are spots in the northern forest zone that do have deer. Your point to when it comes to hunters not actually hunting, I would agree. I think it has become a lot more lax in the years. You know, deer drives are kind of a thing of the past. That was something more prevalent in the late 90s, early 2000s. But going back to those years, the numbers were a lot higher as well. I remember when I was younger hunting in Bayfield and Ashland counties where the deer population was huge, but we also had the zone T hunts. And I think that was a detriment to our deer population as well. So I understand that there are areas and pockets in a lot of these counties where the deer numbers are higher and people are seeing them. And we've heard those concerns. They can still be managed in that regard with crop damage tags and, of course, allowing youth to hunt the youth hunt. But again, from a vast majority of the people that came out to our listening sessions, we heard a lot about just more predators and less deer. And I believe a lot of these guys are also avid hunters. A lot of them referring back to the glory days of the late 90s and the early 2000s. And I do believe that they too have put their time in the woods. So we take all that input, and this is the mass, this is the majority of the population. This is what they were telling us. And like I say, I don't know that it'll hurt our deer population to stop killing them for the next 4 years while we put together a proper deer management plan.
What about a baiting issue that Mike brings up, placing bait to hunt deer or feeding deer, which is banned by state law? Mike said it's very prevalent out there.
It is. I don't question that at all. And he is right. You know, I hunt. I actually live near the federal forest, the Chequamegon National Forest here in Bayfield County. And you're right. About the week before rifle season, every gentleman and deer hunter from the surrounding states comes and dumps a pile of corn out in the forest and expects to see a deer in there. But the ones that are here hunting all the time are also telling me that they didn't see deer. Now, this year was different as well when it comes to the warm weather we were having. Deer had all the natural food sources that they can access at their disposal this year too. So those factors are brought in, and we definitely have considered them. But again, to put together a proper management plan, these numbers, the numbers that we've been seeing when it comes to deer harvest and hunter population and everything, we're factoring all that in, and we're seeing a decline in everything. So there again, we hope to sit down and take in all the information from CEDAX and all the interested parties in the Northern Forest Zone and put together a proper management plan. I think the course on which we're set needs to change. And discussing that with the DNR, they too agreed that there should be some change because the Northern Forest Zone is such a unique area. It should probably have its own plan. So hopefully over the next 4 years, we can do that.
Republican State Representative Chance Green of Grandview in northern Wisconsin as we talk about deer hunting regulations. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Tim in Green Bay is here. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm really curious on how a politician believes that they can come up with a better plan on managing the deer herd in northern Wisconsin better than biologists. What science are you basing your numbers on?
Gotcha. So I'm basing my science off all of my constituents and everyone calling into our office complaining about the deer seasons and the decline in deer population. I, as a legislator, don't believe I should have to act when it comes to the deer population, but something needs to be done, and that is my job to legislate. If the DNR isn't going to change course, I will then legislate to do so. And like I said, this plan isn't to be adversarial to the DNR. It is to simply put a halt on our deer harvest and hopefully sit down with them over the next 4 years, because they have the biologists. You are correct. I'm not saying that I'm smarter than them. I just would like us to revisit northern Wisconsin, and hopefully we can revise the plan and the course that we're currently on, because something needs to be done before it's too late and we don't have a deer herd to protect.
I want to ask you about these deer advisory councils. How much influence should deer councils have on state regulations?
Well, again, I think the CEDAX were well-intended. They had great intention. I just don't know that they were implemented properly. And the reason I say that is because over all six of these listening sessions, the most common complaint was CEDAX weren't taking in public input. Now, CEDAX built up of multiple facets. You have the DNR, you usually have a forestry member, you have public input. There's a lot of people that sit at these places, and for good reason. They all bring, just like I say, when it comes to putting a plan together, we need to have all the interested parties at the table. And the CEDAX are built up with that. But a lot of people are seeing CEDAX make actions that aren't related or relative to the comments being put out or the numbers that they're seeing. So I think that we need to put a pause on the actions that our CEDAX are committing are moving forward. And like I say, revisit that. Do they need more empowerment? Do we need to take in more public input? Do we need to revise how they work and how they work in northern Wisconsin? So again, over the next 4 years, hopefully we could revisit that and fine tune anything in regard.
I want to jump in here and bring on Jeff in Iron County. Iron County was the only county in the state that had a buck-only harvest last year. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for the show. I think this idea is absolutely ridiculous. It's just another case of the legislature meddling with the scientific data that our DNR scientists have every right to are much more an expert on the subject, I guess I should say. The last time I recall that the legislature got involved is when Scott Walker hired James Kroll to come up from Texas, and that, to me, was an absolute disaster. He took away our registration stations, so we went to online registration. That eliminated the DNR's ability to collect age data. He also changed the wildlife habitat units into county units, which totally threw away 50 years of their data on that part.
And so Jeff, I want to jump in here because we're short on time. Representative Green, what would a 4 years look like working with the DNR very quickly?
So it would address those issues completely. I agree. Going from the countywide to back to a deer management unit would be great. Dr. Deer targeted some things. I agree. We should also have in-person registration. So these are things that we could address over the next 4 years, as well as the multiple issues I brought up throughout the conversation today.
Representative Chance Green, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Republican Representative Chance Green of Grandview, first elected to the Assembly in 2022. The Northern Wisconsin District includes Ashland, Bayfield, Iron, and Price counties. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the legislative session winds down and Governor Tony Evers signs into law more than a dozen Senate bills, we reflect on measures that gain traction, and you could be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesse Opoyan is here, state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jesse, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And Emily Fannin here as well, Capitol reporter for WDJT-TV and host of Capitol Connection, a weekly politics show. Emily, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Emily, let's start with you. So the state Senate held what is expected to be its last floor voting period of the year. Next voting period would be in 2025. How would you characterize, summarize the year for the Wisconsin legislature?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge kind of the big hauls that we saw with a lot of bipartisan support. Of course, we hear a lot about, you know, we're in divided government. It's very difficult for things to get done. But acknowledging that, you know, lawmakers passed this massive Brewers bill to fund the stadium. They also got the sweeping shared revenue bill, which would give a boost to local governments for them to spend on, you know, EMS services, police, et cetera, other things like that. We also saw a really big bill to overhaul the state's alcohol laws. So to me, in the end, we saw this kind of big bipartisan push to get that all done. Of course, these were all bills that were signed by the governor, too. And there was a lot of closed doors meetings, which we don't see a lot, between the governor's staff and GOP leaders trying to hammer out all the details of a lot of these bills. I think when you wrap up the legislative session, though, I know me and Jesse have done plenty of stories on this of kind of what got done and what didn't get done. And, you know, Tuesday, which was the state Senate's expected to be last day and scheduled day on the floor, I think it was more of a day of what didn't get done because there was two really big bipartisan bills that, you know, there's a lot of chatter about. I'm talking about the Monday processing bill that would allow clerks to process absentee ballots the day before an election. You know, we saw the governor kind of urge lawmakers on both sides to get that done. It was a bill that had passed the assembly, but it never was brought to a vote on the floor last Tuesday. There was also what's called ROFR, the right of first refusal. It's a very heavy lobbied transmission line bill. I would say probably one of the most heavily lobbied bills this session at the state capitol, and we didn't see either of those bills come to the floor. And I think the big question was, well, you know, Democrats could have helped Republicans get those bills across the finish line, but talking to some lawmakers after session, they weren't really asked to get that done. And there's often what we call the rule of 17 in the state legislature, which is when all Senate Republicans want to have 17 votes to get a bill passed. Well, you know, Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahue didn't have that magic number of 17, and that was kind of a big reason why they didn't bring up those bills. So that was kind of how I would wrap up kind of the last day and, you know, kind of some of the big thumbs up, I guess we saw too, with lawmakers coming together on other items.
Yes. Thank you so much for that tour. Now, Jesse, give us your tour and how you would characterize the 106th legislature.
I would say, you know, just about everything that Emily just said.
Similar stops.
But, I think we saw often, you know, during the legislative session, you hear people, you know, talk about, you know, no one works together, no one gets anything done. And you'll usually hear lawmakers say, well, you know, actually, we pass a lot of bipartisan bills. The thing is, they're just not very high profile bills. It's, you know, things taking care of local ordinances or, you know, things that just don't make the headlines and aren't controversial. But this year, we did see a lot of really high profile bipartisan work. That may be because lawmakers are feeling the pressure a little bit with new maps coming to, you know, get some stuff done and be able to work together. But Emily said, you know, that Monday count bill, it seemed like it was going to be a slam dunk. You know, really a lot of bipartisan support for that and just didn't make it to the Senate. And the right of first refusal, it was the most lobbied bill. It, like, by far, the number of lobbying hours outpaced other legislation, including the alcohol bill and the shared revenue bill. So to see those not get a vote was definitely interesting.
I'm going to throw one more thing in the mix here. We have new legislative district maps. So we saw the Assembly and Senate, you know, pass the governor's proposed maps. You know, what do you make of that roller coaster, Emily? And what are you watching for?
Yeah, I mean, roller coaster is to put it lightly, too, because I think none of us as political reporters would have imagined that it would come down to Republicans passing Evers maps without any changes. Now, don't forget, they, of course, tried to at first, the first go around, to make what they called very slight changes to protect many Republican incumbents. But in the end, I think they either were concerned that if they went to the court, there could be even, you know, more favorable changes to Democrats. So they were kind of in this corner where this might be the last resort that we go with. And that's what they did. So I thought that was surprising. So, but you're right, though. I mean, this was another thing where we saw kind of lawmakers put their political differences aside to get this big issue done. I think going forward, there's so many questions ahead. And I think the biggest one with the new legislative maps right now that is in the news is, what are the rules going to be around future recall elections? Of course, we know there is an effort that continuously that is going to be pushed to try and oust Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. We know signatures turned in last week after an initial review said that number fell short. But I think, looking ahead, there's still going to be questions of if there is another recall, or, you know, even we have an empty state Senate seat that's usually heavily Democrat after a state Senator Lena Taylor left to serve in the Milwaukee County Court. You know, what happens to those? Are we going to use the old maps, the new maps? I think it's going to be an issue that would likely be decided by the state Supreme Court, and kind of questions ahead. Is that the body that should be deciding this going forward?
Jesse, what comes up for you in the thorny issues going ahead with the legislative maps?
Yeah, I mean, I think Democrats found themselves asking, you know, what's the catch here? Is are Republicans playing a trick, or do they have something up their sleeves? And I think, you know, the simple answer is Republicans saw this as the least worst option for them out of the possible outcomes that could have come from the court. There was definitely some pressure from Democrats, particularly in D.C., I would say, against Governor Tony Evers to not sign the maps, but which he obviously did. Going forward, I think, you know, an interesting thing that, you know, it comes up anytime there is redistricting is the incumbents that are potentially pitted against each other. Do you have, you know, people who decide not to run? Do you have incumbents who end up having to run against each other? And do you see candidates sort of start to moderate a little bit as primaries are maybe less of a driver because the maps are more competitive? You might see, I think, you know, the maps that we have, and it's, you know, not unique to Wisconsin, but, you know, primaries end up being really, really important. And I think pushing candidates on both sides of the aisle to sort of the partisan extremes. And as the maps become more competitive in the general elections, we might see that come back to the center a little bit.
or talking with a pair of State House reporters about the legislature wrapping up its scheduled floor votes. Jesse O'Poyne there from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Emily Fannin from WDJT-TV. You can join in. Questions and comments, reflections on the legislative session. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesse, before we move on, I just want to give a moment to shared revenue and boosting the amount of money that the state shares with local communities. You know, City of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County was in a financial crisis, and then there is shared revenue that passes this legislature. What will the impact be like?
I mean, it'll be huge for not just for Milwaukee, but for really local government throughout the state. You know, as Emily mentioned earlier, this is money that is used to fund just basic local public services, emergency services, just running local government. So, you know, there's not really a community that's not going to benefit a little bit from this. And for Milwaukee in particular, it really kind of rescues them from a fiscal cliff that they were about to fall off.
Well, let's move on. Emily, last week, the Senate fired 8 Democratic appointees. In total, Senate Republicans have rejected 21 of Evers' nominations since 2019. What is significant about rejecting appointees to various commissions and boards?
Well, it's just setting kind of a new precedent that we haven't seen before. You know, to be fair, this is 4 Republicans, a power that they have had for a very long time. They get the final say, get the final check mark on these individuals, who most of them are volunteers to do these positions. But as, you know, politics is, things are becoming more political. So in a sense, Republicans are kind of using this power in divided government to say, hey, you know, if we find something wrong in your background, or you were a longtime Democratic supporter or fundraiser, we don't believe, in their words, that they can be nonpartisan on some of these boards. What I thought was very interesting on the final day, too, specifically about some of these appointments, were to the Judicial Commission, because prior to Tuesday's floor session, it's believed that the state Senate has never voted down a nominee to that body. Hmm. And it's about 46-year history. So in kind of one day, Senate Republicans knocked out 4 of another on the Judicial Commission. Of course, in another flurry of other rejections that we saw, that kind of just continues to lower the bar on the grounds to reject an executive branch nominee. You know, it's just fascinating to watch that this has been a real challenge. But on the other hand, once someone gets rejected, Governor Evers is kind of firing right back and saying, well, if you don't like that person, I got someone, you know, next in line to serve in this role. But it's been really fascinating just to watch, because, you know, some of these individuals, you know, it could just be something that, you know, you didn't even really think was almost on your rap sheet, that in the past, lawmakers wouldn't be so nitpicky about. But, you know, like I said, I mean, rightfully so, they have this power to do this. And this is kind of how they like to serve, as kind of like their check and balance on state government. We also see it too with the Joint Finance Committee. You know, they approve state budgets. They, you know, slated money, for example, $125 million to fight PFAS, forever chemicals, and drinking water and groundwater. Yet the money is, you know, there. But Joint Finance, if they're not going to like the plan, it's a committee, the budget committee that's controlled by Republicans, if they don't like it, they're going to shoot it down. So it's kind of, in a sense, I also see how Republicans are kind of clinging on to the powers that they have in divided government as well.
Hmm. Jesse, two people in particular, John Miller and Dana Walks, were members of the Board of Regents of the Universities of Wisconsin system, were 2 appointees rejected. What are Republicans saying about their reasoning for these firings in particular?
Not much, actually. you know, there have been, to Emily's point on the Judicial Commission, we did hear some actual reasoning on that from the chair of the committee that heard those. And he had concerns about just their knowledge of the committee in general and their ability to be nonpartisan on it. We really haven't heard much of anything about why the regents were rejected or most of the other appointees. You know, another interesting stat to throw out there: since 2019, the Senate has rejected 21 nominations. Prior to that, between 1981 through 2018, they had only rejected 4. So we're really seeing this ramp up quite a bit. And some of them we hear conversation about, and some of them they just kind of they throw them out without a lot of explanation.
We have journalists who cover state politics and government, Jesse O'Poyan at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Emily Fannin at WDJT-TV. You can be part of the discussion about proposals you followed this legislative session, discussions you followed. Call in with a question. Share your perspective, 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Assembly and Senate stand adjourned. We discuss measures that gain traction at the end of scheduled floor votes this year in the legislature. And you can be part of the state politics conversation. Call in with a question, add your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Emily Fannin is here, Capitol reporter for WDJT-TV and co-host of Wisconsin Eyes Rewind. Jesse O'Poyan is state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Let's go to Jack in Madison now. Jack, go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Kate.
Good morning, guests.
So a development that I recall seeing from earlier in this legislative session was the push to create a Wisconsin film office and tax incentives to bring Hollywood studios to shoot in our state. I might have mentioned that on an episode of Central Time, but I thought that was interesting because I didn't necessarily expect a bipartisan effort in the assembly to come together to make that happen. And so I was curious if your guests had more insight into that than my other point before you turn it over to them is, seeing as there's been a bit more cooperation on the bipartisan level in the state legislature, I wondered if part of that had to do with the fact that now that we have new maps, the current structure that Republicans in the legislature were operating with was kind of on borrowed time. So either way, they know that things are going to look a little different in the next few election cycles. So wondered how much of that was the case as well.
Jack, thank you so much for calling in those insights. Emily, I'm going to toss to you on the film credits because you were writing about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I did a story on that. And just, you know, to be clear, the bill didn't come out till much later, Jack, in the legislative session. But there was a lot of talk of it. So I think that's one of the main reasons we just didn't see this larger push to get it across the finish line. It was also a conversation that's been, you know, of the lawmakers that I spoke to, that's been going on for almost the past 15 years. It was almost 16 years ago, I believe, is when the last time Wisconsin offered tax incentives like this to make Wisconsin more lucrative for film production, producers, reality TV, I mean, the whole gambit. So now that it's bipartisan, I think we could definitely see this something as an issue that reemerges next legislative session. So I definitely wouldn't call it, you know, dead. It's definitely very, very much alive, but it's taken a long time to convince, at least what I hear, many Republicans to get on board with this, because this is something that the Governor Walker's administration actually got rid of after there was kind of this failed effort when Public Enemies, which is, of course, had some infamous shots and filmed here in Wisconsin, they got a huge tax incentive that didn't really help out the state as much. They were promised to bring in much more money than they originally did. So it kind of gave the tax incentives a bad look. So they're trying to restructure that image once again. And of course, they've tweaked the kind of the guidelines and the thresholds of how film production companies would meet in order to get tax incentives. So definitely something we'll be keeping an eye on in the next legislative session if they can get it done.
Okay, watching down the road there. And Jesse, the other comment about the maps, Jack making a point that, Republicans cooperating because they feel like the current power structure is on borrowed time. We heard the governor saying now the legislature will be up for grabs. Will it?
To a degree, yes. You know, it certainly would have been a much more dramatic situation if there was an element of the MAPS lawsuit that would have actually put every single member of the legislature up for re-election. The court opted not to go that route. So you'll have everyone in the assembly up for re-election, but only half of the Senate. So so there's less to be gained for Democrats than might have been originally, but there's certainly, everything's on the table. And I do think it's a little bit of both. It's certainly the thought of the new maps coming down the pike, but also it's you just see such an increasingly the public is increasingly frustrated with the inaction that comes from government at every level. And it was a little bit different under complete Republican control because they could pass a lot of things, but under divided government, things move slower. And I think legislators are starting to sense that the public is a little frustrated with that.
Jesse, are there any high-profile bills that surprised you that died during this legislature? We heard Emily bringing up a couple. Anything for you there that you were surprised met an end?
Yeah, there were a few. There was an effort from a Madison assembly member to create a task force to study violence against Black women and girls. It received just overwhelming bipartisan support in the assembly. We know that disparities exist in that regard, and they're especially bad in Wisconsin. So there was a lot of support to get that through, but it got held up in the Senate. There were a lot of lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who were pretty frustrated about that. Similarly, so that got held up in the Senate. On the assembly side, there was a lot of support for a bill that would have extended postpartum Medicaid coverage. Again, a lot of support, a lot of bipartisan support. The governor supported it, but that failed to cross the finish line in the assembly.
Jesse O'Poyen at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Emily Fannin at WDJT TV, as we talk with two State House reporters about the legislature wrapping up its scheduled floor votes. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Nate in Milwaukee is here. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me this morning. I was going to run through two quick things. The first is, it sounds like members of the legislature rejecting some of Governor Evers' appointments are basically playing politics even more and possibly trying to engage in censorship. The other is, I want to ask about any proposed state constitutional amendments. I make a habit of voting any of them that I see on the ballot, and I understand that some are being proposed this year, including trying to ban local governments from accepting nonprofit grants to help do their elections, which strikes me as odd because that's not going to change the votes. And if there are people so short-staffed that voters can't have full access to the ballot, that's actually a problem in trying to undermine people's ability to get their votes in.
Nate, thank you for the call. Jesse, what do you see happening in the area of constitutional amendments?
Sorry, you can't, for just a second there, you asked about the constitutional amendments?
Yes,
Yep. The private funding bill is definitely a controversial one. So this stems back to some grants that went out, particularly during the pandemic, from an organization that receives a lot of funding from Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. The bulk of that money went to the state's five largest cities to help them run elections during the pandemic. Those cities happened to trend Democratic, so there is some concern from Republicans about that. So they call it the Zuckerbucks Amendment. I'll be curious to see how voters feel about that. We haven't really gotten a lot of sense of what the public sentiment is on that. These local communities definitely have needed help in running elections. So I think their response would be, if you're going to ban, these private grants, then the state's going to need to chip in more to help us.
And Emily, I just want to toss to you here in the last few moments about how you see constitutional amendments trending in the Republican-controlled legislature.
Yeah, it's definitely that we're seeing become a popular option among Republicans, given that this is their avenue to get measures across the finish line, get it on the ballot before voters, by skirting Governor Tony Evers' veto pen. So he cannot veto constitutional amendments that are a little bit more difficult than just passing a regular bill in the state legislature. They have to pass two consecutive sessions. So usually takes, you know, a little over 2 years for these efforts to get through. And then they are basically have to be implemented before voters. It's becoming more popular.
Yeah, they skirt the governor's desk. I want to thank both of you for joining us and for this recap. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Jesse Apoyan, state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Emily Fannin, WDJT-TV. You're listening to the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With hundreds of commercial vessel shipwrecks in Wisconsin waters, we meet a maritime archaeologist who has visited nearly all of them. The wreck of the Trinidad near Algoma was recently named to the State Register of Historic Places. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tamara Thompson is part of the Maritime Preservation Program at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Tamara, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. So this month we see two shipwrecks in Wisconsin waters being added to the state's Register of Historic Places. How were you involved in adding the Trinidad and the Mojave shipwrecks to the State Historic Register?
Well, part of my job is to evaluate the resources for the state. And in doing so, we try to investigate newly discovered shipwrecks. We dive down on them or take robotics down and look at the shipwrecks and determine their eligibility for listing to the National Register. The State Register of Historic Places is just the first step in getting the resources listed to the National Register, which provides them a federal layer of protection under the law.
What stands out about these two shipwrecks?
Oh my goodness, both of these shipwrecks are in about 300 feet of water. Both of them are fully intact, so they haven't lost any bit of integrity. They look like they could be raised and sailed away, maybe with a little bit of help tomorrow. But everything is there. Everything that was on the ship that was taken down, taken with it aboard by the sailors, is now down on the site today. So it's really a time capsule.
How could they be so intact? What has caused that?
Well, in both cases, they sank very slowly. The Trinidad was taking on water, and they had the men working the pumps when the ship slipped below the waves underneath them. With the Mojave, it was sailing through a storm, and another ship was sailing ahead of it and reported seeing the ship following them, but was lost in a trough. So the event of sinking wasn't a collision. The cargo that they were carrying wasn't intensely heavy. So when the ships did hit the bottom, they didn't break up and they remained largely intact.
Tamara, how geographically close are the two shipwrecks? Can you kind of map it out for us?
Sure. So the Trinidad is about 10 miles off, directly out of Algoma in northern Kewaunee County. So almost to the Door County border and directly offshore. So in again, about 300 feet of water. And the Mojave is about 13 miles offshore out of the Sheboygan area.
Okay. Are both shipwrecks from a similar time period?
Yes. Roughly. The Trinidad was built in 1867 and lost in 1881, and the Mojave was only afloat for a year. It was built in 1863 and lost in 1864.
We are talking about shipwreck preservation with Tamara Thompson, maritime archaeologist with the State Historic Preservation Office of the Wisconsin Historical Society. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tamara, 88 shipwrecks in Wisconsin waters are on the State Historical Register. What qualifies a shipwreck to be placed on the State Historical Register?
There's a number of features that can allow a shipwreck to be placed on the register. It can be the work of a master shipbuilder that designed the ship. So almost the architecture that goes into making a particular ship. It could be that it's associated with an important person, or it could be that it's associated with an event in history. It also has a lot to do with the integrity of the ship. So how much is still there? It can be broken. I mean, these two that we're speaking of are intact, but they could be broken, but representative of all the pieces of the ship that are on the bottom. So there's a number of things that we look at, and no shipwreck is the same. They may have similarities, but they all have a unique item to add to our understanding of this time in our history.
Does the National Register have similar qualifications as the state?
It does. So when we list these, the process is that we go out and we determine whether we believe that they are eligible. We write up a nomination. It is the National Register of Historic Places nomination form that goes before a state committee. The state committee is comprised of 15 members, which are governor appointed, and they have areas of expertise where they're able to review our nomination, and it's listed to the state register first, signed in by the state historic preservation officer. From there, any amendments are made to the nomination as suggested by the committee, and then it's passed on to the National Park Service, who has their own review process for listing on the National Register.
Okay, so multiple steps there, that process. Let's bring in Richard in Two Rivers. Richard, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the air. I'm 65, and I guess it was back in 83. I was bartending up in Sauk Center, and a trucker came by that happened to be a diver as well, and he dived some of the wreckage sites. And he told me that he had, I believe it was Lake Superior. It was a long time ago. I'm trying to remember it. He said he believed it was Lake Superior where he went down to a wreckage, and there were bodies inside the cabin of the men that perished during the wreckage. He said that he went back 3 years later, and he noticed that the wedding band was off of the man's finger. So my question is there pillaging that goes on established sites from divers?
Richard, thank you for that question. Tamara?
Well, that's always a risk, and we're hoping to lead with education. The mentality of the divers has really changed over the years. It used to be that it was finders keepers. If you found a shipwreck, it was felt that it was yours to loot. However, the states all have had different laws in effect which protect these resources. And in Wisconsin, our laws that protect shipwrecks started as early as 1965. So it has been illegal under state law to remove anything from the shipwrecks. In 1987, the federal government came in and passed the Abandoned Shipwreck Act, which gave title to the resources on the bottomlands to the states, given a number of provisions. One, that it was embedded in state bottomland. One, that it had been embedded in coralline structure, and we don't have coral here in the Great Lakes. One, that it's determined eligible, and another, that it's listed on the National Register of Historic Places. So we try to, again, affect laws which protect the resources. And in this case, all the states have burial laws also. So these are places that men worked and lived and sometimes died. And this is their final resting place. So those laws are also in effect.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist at the Wisconsin Historical Society as we explore recent efforts to preserve Wisconsin shipwrecks. Call in with a question, share your perspectives at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about recent efforts to preserve and protect shipwrecks found in Wisconsin waters and how underwater archaeologists unearth this lost history. You can be part of the discussion about shipwrecks. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tamara Thompson works on the Maritime Preservation Program in the State Historic Preservation Office. Let's bring in Donald in Merrill. Donald, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi, Meiji. This is Don from Merrill, Wisconsin. And I have a two-part question. One is, what is the oldest shipwreck you have found in Wisconsin waters? And secondly, maybe it's the same answer, is what is the most interesting one that you found in your opinion? Thank you.
Thank you. Tamara.
So the oldest known shipwreck in Wisconsin waters is one called the Galley Nipper. It is located in about 210 feet of water off just north of Sheboygan area. So it was built in 1832 for a gentleman named Michael Dowsman. So maybe a lot of people around the state realize that there's a lot of Dowsmans that are around. It's there's Dowsman streets and there's the town of Dowsman and so on. This is the same family. So Michael Dowsman was the patriarch. He was the Western agent for the John Jacob Astor American Fur Company out of Mackinac. And he was bringing furs in from this region and then shipping them to Buffalo. When his family started flourishing, he had sons that went to Milwaukee, George and Talbot. George opened a warehouse and Talbot moved inward to where Waukesha County is now and established a farm at the town of Dowsman. So that shipwreck is associated with that family. It was used to, again, supply this developing city of Milwaukee. The Dowsmans also petitioned the government to have the Milwaukee Harbor dredged out and made navigable. So that's our oldest. I think it is a very interesting shipwreck. It is completely intact. All of the rigging, one mast remains standing, but most of the rigging has fallen off to one side. It just looks really old too when you're down there looking at it. It was completely empty when it sank because they had lengthened the vessel at one time in its service career. It tended to roll over when it was hit by unexpected storms, and that's what brought it to the bottom. And the most interesting shipwreck that I've seen is always the next one. So so we're going to be out looking at one called the George Newman, which was discovered by a father and daughter that were out fishing. It's in very shallow water just south of Green Island in Green Bay. So I'm always learning. I'm not going to stop on one and say that that's the best one. It's always going to be the next one that's out there. And the open being open to exploration of these resources.
Do you dive during a certain time of year, or can you go down like any time?
That's a tricky question. So yes, you can dive anytime. However, in the late fall, all of the municipalities pull out the resources for being able to launch boats. So the piers are not there. And sometimes Green Bay freezes over. So you can't get out of the harbors in and go look at these shipwrecks all of the time. However, for me, we look at other things during the winter season. There's a number of inundated mine sites that are around the state. So in the southwestern part of the state, there are lead mines, lead zinc mines, and we're diving in those year round. So although I won't look at shipwrecks, I look at other submerged resources.
Oh, wow. So, you went into great detail about the background of the Galley Nipper. Are those mm-hmm. types of details found in a National Register application?
Yeah, we go and we will research the service history of the vessel from its build and builders all the way through the sinking in as much detail as we can find. And a lot of times those papers will be, 50 to 75 pages long. We also do a very detailed site description of what is on the bottom, taking measurements that we're able to collect from, in these cases, robotics, because they were in the 300-foot range, so it limited the amount of time divers could spend on the bottom. But we work with a partner named Tom Crossman, Crossman Consulting, and he has robotics that have multi-beam sonar on them, so he can take images of these vessels, and we're able to take measurements, and those detailed measurements then populate the National Register nomination.
You are a professional diver and recognized on the Women Divers Hall of Fame. Lynn from Milwaukee called in and is wondering how you became a maritime archaeologist.
I became a maritime archaeologist completely by accident. I was in the right place at the right time. So I had been working in the geology and geophysics department at the University of Wisconsin, setting up experiments underwater in lead mines. And the woman that I was working for won the MacArthur Genius Grant and left. And so I came to volunteer at the State Historical Society at a time when the National Marine Sanctuary up in Alpena, Michigan, the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary, was starting up, and our office was gutted. Everyone left and went to work for the National Marine Sanctuary, and they asked if I would stay around and write up some of the work that I had volunteered on until they found someone better to come along. And that was 20 years ago, so I'm still here. And but there's been a lot of hard learning on the job. This is not something that I went to school for. This is really a second or third career for me. So, I would not be one to offer career advice. Most people go to school for this. There are a number of master's and PhD programs around the country. So, again, completely by accident and right place at the right time. So, but I couldn't ask for anything more. It is so interesting.
We're talking with Tamara Thompson, accidental maritime archaeologist with the State Historic Preservation Office of the Wisconsin Historical Society, discussing shipwrecks. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Tamara, how would the public benefit from legally protected historical sites like shipwrecks?
So all of these resources tell a portion of our history. So everything from the indigenous watercraft that we work with in the inland lakes, all of the canoes, all the way up through these modern commercial craft. So these are resources, they're time capsules that tell our history. And we try to, again, through education, leave them the way they are so that the next generation of divers, the next generation of explorers can find these things in the same state that they're in now or very similar. So we again, protect them so that because these are resources that belong to all of us as citizens of this state. It's just our job here at Wisconsin Historical Society to protect them. And one of the ways that we protect them is through the affecting these laws.
And from what I understand, you can see some of these shipwrecks by kayak and not just diving. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. So we've been working with Wisconsin Coastal Management Program and Wisconsin DNR, and there's what's called the Wisconsin State Water Trails. So it's a Lake Michigan water trail and a Lake Superior water trail. It talks about put in and take out places and places to camp. And we've added a layer of shallow water shipwrecks and pier sites to that. So you can see historic lumber piers and all the dock pilings and learn a little bit of the history as you paddle over. Just do a search for Lake Michigan State Water Trail or Lake Superior State Water Trail, and all those resources are right at your fingertips.
Do people need any type of special permission or qualifications to visit the shipwreck sites?
No, all of the shipwrecks are available for people to visit by boat or kayak, paddle, stand up paddleboard. We have people that do that too. Dive or snorkel. And we put all of the known resources up on wisconsinshipwrecks.org, which is a website that we run in partnership with the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. And you can look by regional area, you can look by name of shipwreck, and all of the known shipwrecks will populate on there, but also all the unknown shipwrecks will populate. Mm-hmm. So we know of about 280 shipwrecks in Wisconsin waters, but through our research, we found that there are over 700 that have been lost here. So there's always shipwrecks that are being exposed from the sand up on beaches. And so if you do find a shipwreck when you're paddling or walking the beach or out diving, please let us know, and then we can make that resource available for others to enjoy.
And very quickly, is that normally how you find shipwrecks or learn about them? Is it through that word of mouth?
Yes, and it's pretty crazy. Last year, we had 13 new shipwrecks reported to us. So in normal years, we'll see 2 or 3 shipwrecks. But last year, we had a lot of people looking that were successful in finding them. And then also, we had them reported. So this is just a treasure trove of information that we're still trying to work through.
Tamara, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist with the State Historic Preservation Office of the Wisconsin Historical Society. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Milwaukee theater company requests that we brace ourselves for an impending apocalypse. It's a new stage production open Saturday at Zao Milwaukee Church. Be part of this theater conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jamelyn Gray is an actor, producer, and founder of the theater group The Constructivists and director of the production Acapocalypse, or Oconomowoc-Capella's acapella practice has been canceled. Jamelyn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
What got into you with this title?
I mean, I guess it would be great if we could get the playwright on here this morning, or the playwrights on here this morning. The title is one of the reasons why I fell in love with this play in the first place. I read that title and was just leaping with joy because even just saying it brings a smile to your face.
So it's someone else's problem, right?
it's somebody else's brain and not mine, unfortunately. I wish I could claim that title was my title.
Is there any a cappella music to be had in this play?
You know, not as much as you would think with a title like that. I think that's part of what's funny about it. It's something that we talk about all the time, is how the limited amount of a cappella singing in this production.
Well, the play is also a group effort. Can you talk about how it's being written?
Yeah, Andrew Hobgood and Jolino are the two playwrights of this production. And, you know, Andy was the one who really started out with the treatment of this, where he was the one who came up with the story and the storyline. And Joe is his partner and writing partner. And they collectively came up with the story. They made a list of characters. And then we found the actors to fill those roles, and the actors themselves really develop the characters that they are given. They are the ones who figure out their background, their full story, what they would carry in their backpack kind of thing. And through that process, then they give these characters over to the playwrights. Then they go away, they write this script in full, and then they come back and we start developing the work.
Wow. So do you feel there, I think there are about 9 members of this cast. Do you feel like there you have that buy-in to have that contribution from the actors? It's not just like, hey, here's a script, do this. You're actually asking the actors to make a significant contribution to the creative element.
I think it's one of the best parts of this process, and I think the actors would say the same, that you really get ownership of this piece. I mean, it's a world premiere that you yourself have created a piece of this work. And yeah, you can absolutely say, I did this, I did that, I made up this line, I made up that line, and there's something just really special about that.
How, I'm wondering, you know, because sometimes you think of a script coming together and someone is just, you know, at a computer writing it. But when you have all of these contributors, I mean, does technology help? How do you bring a script together when there are so many people providing their piece of it and so much input on it?
Well, we got together in workshop form after Joe and Andy would go away and write a little bit and then come back. We this was originally developed for our under construction play development series last year. And we had a few workshops, maybe I think it was just 3, before we did a reading of this work before our fundraiser last year. But it was really out of that process that I decided I think this is a great work, and really under the Constructivist brand, I really think that we should bring this to full production. And then after that, then we did 3 or 4 more workshops after that, where we all got it together in a room. We read the script, we, you know, gave thoughts on where it was going, what the characters were doing, and, shaped and reshaped. And then we officially got together at the beginning of February to really start the actual rehearsal process to bring it to full production.
Jamelyn, you mentioned the Constructivist brand, and I wonder, what does this Milwaukee Theater Company stand for? What is its mission?
We believe in dark art catharsis. We really invest our time into works that are dark comedy, drama. This script actually leans way more to the funny side of dark and funny. But we feel like there's room in the theatrical universe for works that really take the dark side of human experience and put it on stage. And through that, you know, people can really process dark emotions as they watch our shows.
We're talking about a new devised theater production in Milwaukee with its director, Jamelyn Gray, and the Constructivists and the mission of this company. You can call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Jamelyn, can you, explain more of the plot and why choose the practice of a cappella competitions to ground the plot?
Because it's funny. the actual real plot to the script is that there is an impending apocalypse. It's the evening of the 11th annual regional a cappella competition, and these 9 cast members are part of this a cappella group called the Economowoc Acapellas of Economowoc. and they get together and practice a cappella and sing their songs, and they are going to this, to the finals this upcoming weekend. And as they're getting ready, one of their members rushes in covered in what appears to be blood. And chaos then ensues from this event that they're concerned that the world is at its end.
Are there any like real life historical elements that, that surface in the plot or are influenced in the writing of the play?
Oh, Andy did his research. I will say that I think people will get a kick out of how Wisconsin this actually is. One of my favorite things in the play right now is one of the members does vocal warm-ups with the cast, and the way that this play is set up, the audience is technically part of the ensemble, so you may yourself be part of these warm-ups. And he, Ben Yella is his name. He likes to work in, like the Deer District into his warm-ups and things like that. There's really a lot of Wisconsin about this piece.
Did you ever consider joining the cast of this?
Andy did ask, way back at the start of the thing. And, I'm just one of those people who I'm either a director or an actor. It's not part of my brain process to do both in a theatrical setting. So I was like, you know what? I thank you and I appreciate you, but I'm gonna just stick with the directing on this one.
And you set this play at Zao Milwaukee Church. Can you talk a little bit about that connection?
Yeah, it's been a great partnership. We started rehearsing at Zao, I think it's two years ago now. Time doesn't exist anymore. We really just started rehearsing using their basement space as a rehearsal spot. Because if anybody in Milwaukee in the arts is listening, you know the challenge of finding rehearsal space, finding performance space. It's a real point of contention with all the theater arts groups. But we, through a mutual connection, we were able to find this place and we started rehearsing there. And the more I thought about the way that this season was shaping up, the more I thought, would it be possible to actually perform in that space as well? And we made it happen. And so we did our first ever holiday show this past December in the basement there at Zao, which was called a Very Deadly Constructivist Holiday. And then we are doing Acapocalypse there as well. So we are rehearsing and performing in the same space.
Is that helpful for your cast?
Oh, 100%. It's a literal dream to be able to perform and rehearse and not have to move and have, you know, the ability to do things, you know, almost as early as you want to do them in the same space.
Jamelyn Gray is with us, founder and artistic director of the Milwaukee Theater Company, The Constructivists, and she directs the upcoming production of Acapocalypse. Be part of this conversation about live theater. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Milwaukee theater company called The Constructivists. They call their new production a whirlwind 60-minute absurdist satire We explore Acapocalypse, which opens Saturday. Director Jamelyn Gray is founder, artistic director of this theater company, also an actor and producer. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jamelyn, you founded The Constructivists, and the play comes with a content warning for its inclusion of provoking words, ideas, and actions. How should audiences expect to be challenged by Acapocalypse?
It's really a piece about sort of, you know, clickbait culture and how we fall for things so easily without sometimes really investigating. I'm sure Wisconsin Public Radio has had many shows about that. I put a content warning on every production that we do, because the work that we delve into does deal a lot of times with hard feelings, hard emotions. Sometimes there is a lot of blood. Sometimes that people might be a little unsettled by. And so, but I think it's important. I've often said I would rather you know, do this work on stage. I wish we could do this work on stage rather than have the real Acapocalypse in the real world kind of thing. And so I just think it's important that we have the opportunity as humans to be able to process the darkness.
Are content warnings, do you think, becoming more commonplace with theater companies and with productions?
Absolutely, 100%. I really think it's the up and coming generation who's really opened our eyes to, oh man, I'm really aging myself there. really opened our eyes to just being aware and mindful and sensitive to people's the way that people process certain emotions, and when you're dealing with hard material, that it might just be kind if people need a heads up, that they have a heads up available to them. I like to put on our website that a whole separate page that people can go and look what content is actually in the show, just to also be mindful of people who want to walk into a performance without knowing anything. And so I really try to find the balance there to be thoughtful for everyone.
You mentioned how the audience would be part of this play. Can you talk more about how you engage the audience in this production?
Absolutely. We have the basement set up in sort of a horseshoe pattern, if you would like to call it that, and they will be brought in by the actors and be seated in their various sections: sopranos, altos, tenors, and bass, and be really right there, right in the action. They will have actors sitting next to them at various times. It's very much an in-your-face kind of production.
I wonder how malleable is the script? I mean, if an audience member says something, could an actor riff off of it?
Absolutely. and I hope that there is at least an opportunity or two for that to actually happen, because our actors are, many of them are legit comedic actors who will be able to deal with anything that is thrown at them, no problem.
So one night might, the kind of like the mood one night and what comes up might be different than the next performance.
It's one of my favorite things about theater, is that every night is different. It's, you know, we talk about how ephemeral of an art form it actually is, that every performance has its own mood. Every performance has its own way to go about things.
Do you think audiences like to interact like that with a live play? Or you know, it's like maybe in the past they thought, well, I come, I sit, I be entertained. This is a totally different element. What do audiences think of that?
I think some people like it, and some people, like you say, will be more more reserved and just sit back and watch. And I think our actors have had enough experience with this type of art form and dealing with audience members that I think they'll be able to feel people out of whether or not they want to be an active participant. Part of the script actually requires us to, at the top of the show, pick an audience member to be an actual active participant. Her name is Linda, and she will need to be somebody who is willing to play along a little bit throughout the show.
We're talking about Acapocalypse, open Saturday, and Jamalyn Gray is an actor, producer, founder, and artistic director of The Constructivists and directing this production of Acapocalypse. You can call in questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So theater advocacy is mentioned on several aspects of the Constructivists website. What does theater advocacy mean to the company?
We just wish more people would see it. that theater is such a great art form, a great way to process the world. It really even almost harkens back to that good old-fashioned Greek catharsis thought process of going and watching something and, you know, being able to work through problems. We just believe that if more people were to see more theater, the world would be a better place.
Is it difficult to get people into seats and to distract people enough to get them out of their homes, out of their environments, into a live theater setting with other people?
Yeah, it's always been a challenge. You know, we all remember what it was like to be a theater nerd in high school, right? And be part of the group that was, you know, may or may not be picked on. It has gotten even more of a challenge after pandemic. People have gotten used to being at home and having their creature comforts at home. But, you know, there are lots of studies out there, just sort of anecdotally, that that prove how beneficial theater is as an art form. There was a study done that found that people's heartbeats start beating at the same time as other audience members during a theatrical production. Hmm. It's really getting out into the world and being among your fellow humans, watching something funny or dark or, you know, happy, sad, a musical. There's so much that Milwaukee and Wisconsin has to offer. It would just be great if more people would come out and see us.
In our final moments together, you mentioned the pandemic. Is that era of the theater world behind you? Is everything pretty much back to normal?
I would say not. Mm-hmm. We are still, all of us are definitely still feeling the effects of trying so hard to get people back into seats. I was musing over our holiday production. We only did it for one weekend, so we only had about 90 people come and see that production. But that was actually more people that saw that show than our first production coming back from pandemic. And we were at the Broadway Theater Center in the Third Ward in Milwaukee here. And we did Jen Silverman's Wink, and only 80 people saw that show. We did 9 performances of that production. And so it's been a really, really, really slow climb back. You know, not to mention the challenges that we have with how poor Wisconsin funds the art.
And we have we have to leave it there. Jamelyn Gray, thank you for joining us, founder and artistic director of The Constructivists. And upcoming production is Apocalypse. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.